Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel Network. And it is in those, during these beautiful days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I am sitting with Dr. Yoram Chazoni, the author of The Virtue of Nationalism, new book, which we're going to be talking about in a minute. But I imagine that those of you who have been listening to me for a while, first of all, I interviewed Dr. Chazoni a few years ago in his last book. But he is a political theorist whose work I use in my own work as a tour guide in Israel, especially the book, The Philosophy of Hebrew Scripture, which talks about the tribes, their allotment in the land, their jobs and their positions in Jewish history in terms of leadership, in terms of not leadership, like the fourth brother Judah gets to be the king, which is very unusual. So it's not just political theory to sit on a shelf, but it's ideas about Bible and about our history that are very, very much current. So first of all, Dr. Chazoni Yoram, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so The Virtue of Nationalism, one of my pet themes, my listeners have heard this before, is going over what the best form of government is. Are we looking at the waning days of democracy? What is going on around here? Do we need a benevolent monarch? And your book and what you've spoken about for the last few years, The Virtue of Nationalism, is kind of going against what the current feeling is, right? That nationalism brought upon us two world wars and all the terrible things that are happening in the world are because of nationalism. And here you are putting out a book talking about the virtue of nationalism. So where does this come from?
First of all, it comes from the Tanakh. It comes from the Bible. One of the main points of the book is that the idea of national independence, which at least until a few years ago was still important and current in the West and central to the thinking of Western democratic nations, the idea of national independence is a biblical idea. We don't have any Greek or Roman sources for the idea that a group of tribes can come together, overthrow the rule of a foreign empire, have a king of their own and prophets of their own, and then live within borders that they're not allowed to cross, side by side with other national independent states that live within their own borders. You could say that the God of Israel is the first God in the history of mankind, as far as we know, to give borders to his own people. All of the other gods sent their people out to conquer the entire world, but the God of Israel says, no, that's not just. The world that I want to see is a world that has borders and has nations, each one different from the others, living within their own prescribed bounds.
So do you think then, it occurs to me, that this push against nationalism or erasing borders, the EU and what we're seeing around the world, is somewhat of a push against then a biblical idea, or that's just coincidence?
No, there's no coincidence here. The opposite of this biblical idea is the idea of the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Persians and the Romans. You can say that it's, or of Alexander the Great, you can say that this is the Roman idea, that peace and prosperity will come to the world when a single people conquers everyone and suppresses all the unnecessary friction and competition and war, imposes a single law on all of mankind. And that Roman vision resurrected just is the vision of the European Union. The idea that peace and prosperity can only come by tearing down all the borders and all the national distinctions, eliminating national independence, and placing all nations under the subservience of what's called universal reason. The idea that there's one true idea that you can figure out that's right for absolutely everybody.
There seems to be some kind of dissonance here, because while people are on the one hand talking about total freedoms for anything they want on a personal level, right? Nobody should tell you what to be, what to do. There's no genders anymore. Everything is okay. Yet on the other hand, you're saying that this idea is for there to be some major authority on a national level having some rule. So how does this jive in today's world?
Utopians, people who fantasize about the creation of kind of like a perfect world, mm-hmm. they usually have some kind of contradiction in their thinking. I mean, it's something that makes sense on paper, but it doesn't make any sense in real life, given what human beings have been. Part of what I try to do in the book, In the Virtue of Nationalism, is to focus on the fact that if you're interested in an empirical politics, a politics that's based on experience and reality and what the world is really like, then you can't go with these utopian rationalist political theories. So you're right that from a utopian point of view, you'll assert everyone will be maximally free, and someone will rule the world in order to ensure that everybody is maximally free, and that someone will get all the right answers because that someone is going to be working according to universal reason, and universal reason always gets the right answers. So there is such a theory. It's actually extremely popular today, mm-hmm. both in Europe and America, but it makes no sense. I mean, if we ask empirically on the basis of experience, where has there ever been such a thing? Has there ever been a multinational empire that was ruled on the basis of reason so that everyone was free and no one was oppressed? The answer is no, of course not. The human beings just aren't like that. And the wisdom of the biblical nationalist tradition, which was adopted and adapted by the Protestants in the early modern period and created the world in which we live, a world of independent nation states, that's a world that may not, it isn't utopia, it isn't perfect, but what it does is it says different nations have different perspectives. You can't expect, let's say, that the British that have these 800 years of traditions of individual freedom and limited government, that they could just merge into a government together with the Germans and the French, as they tried to do with the European Union, without suddenly discovering that, no, the Germans and French do not have universal reason, and they don't come to the same answers that the British do. And the British people find themselves enslaved because rather than living according to their own traditions and their own laws and their own freedoms, they live according to the way that Germans and French think that they should live. They have that dictated to them. So this is an old story, but the story is an attempt to overcome utopia, wishful thinking, dreaming about what the world has to be like, and to be more realistic. And maybe some of your listeners will find that odd, that a biblical political theory, a political theory descended from biblical tradition, is actually an awful lot more realistic and true to what human beings are like than an Enlightenment theory, which is based on idealizations of what human beings should be like, but never are.
Well, that's one of the things that's so fascinating about the Bible. First of all, when it comes to like our people, we come from slaves. Like, who's going to put that in their history? Yes, we used to be slaves, and now we're not anymore. And emphasize that and have a holiday about that. So the Bible, for a long time I've realized, is a very, very unusual book. But when did you come in your own personal history to realize that there was a political theory inside of Tanakh, and one that is relevant probably even, as you're saying now, more than ever for today's world?
Well, that was when I went to graduate school, now an awful long time ago. I loved studying Plato and Aristotle and Hume and Burke, and but already in my first months in graduate school in political theory, I was amazed by the degree to which the subjects that the famous books of political thought in the Western tradition deal with the same subjects that the Tanakh does. I mean, obviously it's not a 100% overlap, but it was pretty astonishing first to realize that Plato and Aristotle are talking about the same things that the prophets are talking about. They're facing the same problems. They don't necessarily come up with the same solutions, but it's very similar in terms of subject matter. And that was the first realization. The second realization was that once you get past the Greeks and the Romans, and you're already reading Christian political theorists, they're very conscious of the fact that their ideas are coming from Hebrew Bible. So, it's overwhelming. Because the New Testament is not very much a political text. There's an old famous saying of Charlemagne that if you want to know how to live your life for the next world in order to receive eternal salvation, then you read the New Testament. But if you want to understand how to govern in this world, then you have to read the Old Testament. And although that's a little bit simplistic, it's essentially true. And medieval political thinkers did in fact turn time and again to the Bible as a central source for their ideas. So it's what the surprising part is how the professors sort of skim by all of this. You read the books. One of my oldest and dearest friends in the political theory professor, I once asked him this. I said all these books are packed from end to end with direct, explicit references to Hebrew Bible, and in some cases also to the Talmud and rabbinic literature. And so how is it that when you go to university and you take these courses, that aspect of it is not taught? And he said, well, we don't avoid teaching it on purpose. It's just the way that we're trained. Our eyes just kind of skip over all of the passages that have to do with the Bible as though it's, a decorative or something. And so what happens is that the universities, that they teach all these books, and the books are clearly based on the Bible. So somebody like Hobbes or Locke, they talk about Hebrew Bible all the time. But even thinkers like Rousseau and Nietzsche, who are a little bit less explicit, still they're constantly making reference to Hebrew Bible. And the curriculum is just assembled in such a way that the Bible's just not part of it. You know, you start with the Greeks, which means that you skip the Bible. So the students don't know what's in the Bible, and because they don't know what's in the Bible, they don't know when they're reading later how they don't see the way that the Christians and later the liberal thinkers and conservative thinkers, the way that they bring biblical ideas down to modernity. It's just not part of the way universities work today. It's really a terrible mistake, and one, as you know, that I try to do something about in all of my books, right. This new book on nationalism is just one example of an idea which has been central for at least four centuries in Western political thinking, and its only source is biblical. It doesn't have a Greco-Roman source.
So, are you going to write a curriculum? Is that something that you can do? Or I know that you had told me a few years ago that I believe you had some Christians that had come to you and asked you to write some kind of curriculum, but I don't know if it was this. I mean, is that, because what you're saying is in universities, they're like starting the book in the middle and without the basis and for the thinking that came before.
Well, you know, everything depends on resources. Mm-hmm. Someday someone is going to decide that they want to fund the revision, the reconstruction of the Western curriculum and political ideas. And if they come to me, then I can put together a team and do that for them. Until then, we're just going to have to do with what we've got.
So you mentioned the Christians, though, early Christianity, the medieval thinkers, were including, I imagine, the Rambam, Maimonides, who was also during that time period and one of our greatest thinkers. Yet you make a distinction, a clear distinction, in your book between the Catholic thinking, or what you call the neo-Catholic thinking, and what you said at the beginning, the Protestant philosophy, which is the political system more or less that we're in right now. When does that diverge because of the break from Catholicism? It's always seemed to me, and I've been to Rome a few times, just so you see it physically, but you also learn about it, that it's very much like a monarchy to a great degree, Catholicism, with the Pope as the king and the bishops and everybody down, which you don't have in other branches of Christianity. So where do you see that distinction coming in?
I don't want to make it too simplistic because the Catholics do have they do have the Hebrew Bible, they have the Old mm-hmm. Testament, and in medieval political thought you definitely see the force of Hebrew scripture shaping some of the nations in Europe. I mentioned Charlemagne, who's early medieval, and in general, the French, the tradition of the French kings is very aware of modeling the French nation and the French kingdom on the Davidic kingdom from the Bible, and you can say similar things about the English, the Poles, the Czechs, so. It's not as though, you know, the Catholics simply ignore the Old Testament and it has mm-hmm. no effect, but there is clearly a break in the 1500s with the rise of Protestant states. Henry VIII in 1534 declares independence from the Holy Roman Empire and from the papacy. You know, we learn it like he just wanted to get married, you right. know, a sixth time, and so that's right. what it was all about. But if you think
he wanted a divorce, so he started the Anglican Church.
Right. So, but if you think about this, you know, there's an entire nation there, and there's no chance that the English would have gone along with national independence, an independent church, an independent kingdom, if that had not already been something strongly felt within their traditions. And in fact, if you go back a few decades before Henry, there's a crucial English political theorist named John Fortescue. He was actually the Chief Justice of the English Supreme Court during the Wars of the Roses. And around 1470, which is a long time ago, 1470. Mm-hmm. So this, it's well before Protestantism. He already wrote a book called "In Praise of the Laws of England," which is a nationalist book that people should really read it. I mean, you shouldn't be scared off by the 1470. You can get a modern edition. It reads clear as a bell, and it has in it a description of the English Constitution, which is 300 years before the American founding. Already then, it talks about the separation of powers, due process of law, the bicameral legislature, the executive veto, strong property rights as the basis of freedom and economic prosperity. All these things that, you know, that today people think, these are Enlightenment ideas or American ideas. Here they are in the 1470s, and the difference between Fortescue and the later liberal thinkers well, he's not a liberal, but but one of the major thinkers is that he bases all of this on the Bible, that he opens the book with Deuteronomy and the law of the king in Sefer Dvarim in Deuteronomy, and then proceeds from there to show how the English Constitution is the best constitution that there ever has been, but in part because it's based on biblical principles, which was an old British idea at the time. Now he's still a Catholic, but he's already an English nationalist in a very, very clear way. So when Henry declares independence, he's not doing it out of the blue. He has an entire nation that has a long tradition of seeing themselves as a people shaped by the Old Testament, as a people with special freedoms and special laws that make them different from the other nations. And what Henry does is he really turns national independence into an explicit political principle. Because you're right that Catholicism, although it has a very long and variegated history, Catholicism never gives up on the idea that there's going to be one Christian empire for the whole world. That's why the name Holy Roman Empire. Now, the Holy Roman Empire was more successful at times and less successful at others. And the feudal system is not exactly, you know, the kind of Roman Empire that we're used to thinking of. But on the other hand, Catholicism remained committed to this idea of universal Christian monarchy. And what the Protestants do after 1534 is that one after another, their states declare independence. And this whole idea of declaring independence, that's a Protestant idea taken out of the Old Testament. It doesn't have any other sources. Catholic countries don't beforehand hadn't declared independence from the emperor and the pope. Nobody did that kind of thing. Even the French, who were very close to a completely independent country, did not declare independence from the emperor and the pope. And here we have it for the first time: this ideal of national independence as first of all an expression of a very Jewish idea of national freedom, of freedom of nations, that nations should be able to pursue their own course according to their own laws and their own ways. There may be one God in heaven and one Torah, but the nations, each one has its own direction in Judaism. And the Protestants adopted this and created an order in Europe that eventually spread to the rest of the world, which assumes that you're going to have different nations with different laws, different nations with different religions and customs and traditions. Independence means that they don't have to be all the same. They don't have to be according to one standard. And if you see what's happening in Europe today, I mean, even right now, where the idea of national independence has been effectively renounced by the European Union, and if the Greeks or the Italians, the Poles or the Hungarians or the British, if they want to live their lives according to their way of understanding, then now you have a central power that's emerging, based in Brussels nominally, but in fact in Berlin, which says no, we're gonna punish nations, we'll punish nations, we will dictate the economy to the Greeks, we will determine who is going to be the finance minister in Italy, we will decide whether there's going to be immigration into Hungary and Poland, which anyone who cares about freedom should be astonished and horrified to see this kind of a dynamic where effectively a German imperial government in Europe, with some help from others, but it really is fundamentally a German government, in the name of liberalism, you know, in the name of freedom for everyone, is in fact dictating the domestic politics and law of the nations of Europe. How did we get here, and why shouldn't we resist it? It seems like a dreadful outcome of the last century.
So I was in Greece this summer, and speaking to people, they're saying what you're saying, but they're saying quietly. And I don't know if it's going to get to be a louder rumble, but they're not happy. And what's so fascinating is, even though it's nominally in Brussels, as you said, it's in Berlin, and you used the word imperialistic. And it was you who told me years ago that when we spoke about nationalism, that the world was wrong when it felt that nationalism brought upon it two world wars, because Nazi Germany was not nationalistic. It was actually imperialistic. And that is the biggest danger we have now, while people focus on the nationalist aspect, which, as an aside, is why Israel looks like it's just going against everybody else. While everybody's trying to blur the borders, we're saying Jewish state, and we're trying to bring back some kind of independence and some kind of uniqueness to where we are. And you said to me, it was imperialistic, and that's the big danger coming up. And in the few years since then, what we've seen with Erdogan and the Ottomans and Russia and Putin and obviously Iran and Persia, are we seeing the rise again of imperialism? And do we need nationalism not now as kind of a default mode, but really as a bulwark against what could be instead, which is imperialism? And to add to that, the EU even possibly as some kind of empire, even though it looks much more friendly than, you know, Turkey is today?
Let's go back for a second to the definition of nationalism, which is maybe where we should have started. In the tradition that I was raised in, a nationalist is someone who wants to unify the tribes of a single people, of a single nation, and bring them to independence, and to live to whatever extent possible in peace within borders that divide one nation from another. This view is the opposite of an imperialist view, which says the goal of every state should be to, as much as possible, to conquer distant nations and bring them all under a single rule of law. So if that's the definition, then it's very clear that Nazi Germany never supported a national state system. I mean, in Mein Kampf, Hitler writes explicitly that his goal is for Germany to become what he calls mistress of the globe or lord of the earth. These are expressions that he uses. There was never any moment where Hitler's goal was, let's say, to unite the German, you know, the German speakers of Central Europe. If that had been his goal, he probably could have achieved it. But the invasion of France and of Britain and of Russia doesn't take place because Hitler is a nationalist. Mm-hmm. It takes place because he wants to rule the earth. And I was just reading one of the new biographies of Napoleon. And it's the same story. Napoleon's goal is explicitly that France should rule the earth, and that kind of imperialism, that kind of vision, that says there's no space for anybody else to rule. It's I who have to rule, right? The moment that you have that, then you're not talking about nationalism. You're talking about imperialism. Hitler's goal was to overthrow the order of national states, to destroy it so that it would never rise again. So the constant repetition of nationalism was responsible for the Shoah, nationalism was responsible for World War II, it just doesn't hold any kind of water unless you're just using the word nationalism to mean any bad, any evil, any violent thing that anybody ever does to anyone is nationalist. Well, okay, fine, but I'm a professional. I try to use the words more carefully than that.
So where do you see that now in terms of where we are today, 2018, the 57, 79, if you will, and the rise of the empires again?
A very strange thing took place after World War II. I'm not sure that I completely understand it yet, but the West moved very quickly from, let's say, especially in Europe, Europeans moved very, very quickly from the old theory of a Europe of independent states, a state system with multiple independent nations, to a view whose idea was to dismantle that. Everybody's going to live under one sovereignty, one law, which is classic imperialism. So they went from the imperialism of the Nazis, you know, like the overtly violent and ugly imperialism of the Nazis, and the imperialism of the Marxists, to a kind of liberal imperialism.
Economic imperialism?
No, it's not just economic. Economic imperialism would be if you wanted there to be one market to cover the world, but you'd leave the nation states with their independence intact. That's not what happened. What happened was that the economics was an excuse for dismantling nation states. So Margaret Thatcher, in her book Statecraft, writes about how naive we the British were, that we thought that what we were talking about was coordinating, you know, making sure that the electronic appliances made in Britain could be plugged in other places in Europe. We didn't realize that what actually happened was that you set up these administrative committees which produce laws, and these courts which then adjudicate them and give orders. And with every passing year, they take more power for themselves. And since they're at the top of the pyramid, there's no one to stop them from taking power. And the next thing you notice, you're simply having your laws and your life dictated to you by someone else. Now, the fact that your laws and your life are being dictated by someone else, certainly it's better than if they were, God forbid, Nazis or communists, because, you know, at some level they're civilized people. But on the other hand, how much does that help you if you really do believe something different, and if you're really not like them? I mean, I think that this is especially obvious if you're a Jew or if you're a Christian. Then, you know, for this new imperial use of universal reason, it very quickly comes to the conclusion that, you know, that Brit Milah, circumcision, is contrary to universal reason, and kosher slaughter is contrary to universal reason. So Judaism clearly is not legal under this theory of universal reason, and Christianity is pretty much the same. My Christian friends talk about having the universal reason dictating to them the kind of sex education that's going to be taught in Christian schools, which completely contradicts Christian teaching, and is, if they accept it, will in effect mean that classical Christianity is going to cease to exist. So the fact that the new liberal imperialism is not yet as evil as the Nazi or Marxist imperialism doesn't mean that it's not evil. It doesn't mean that it's not bad. And by the way, it's also not as peaceful as it makes out to be. I mean, if you think about the New World Order, which is that's what Americans call this idea, starting with George Bush, the father, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Reagan never talked like this. You know, Reagan supported communist, anti-communist insurgencies all over the world, but he never talked about, or never executed invasions and occupations of major countries on the other side of the world and wrote constitutions for them. And people, I think, don't understand this, that the old generation of neoconservatives, people like Irving Kristol or Jean Kirkpatrick, when the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, they wanted to go home. They thought that the war was over and it was time to bring the boys home and it was time to start worrying about the disintegration of society in America. They weren't interested in a role where America would take over the entire world and become its policeman. But that view, which beginning with George H.W. Bush, the father, declares, now we're moving into a new world order. And Bush said that this order is going to, for the first time in thousands of generations, we're going to achieve what mankind has never been able to achieve before, which is to replace the law of the jungle with the rule of law. And what he means by rule of law is he's talking about one law for the entire planet that's going to come out of the Security Council and is going to be imposed by American armed force.
So you're saying here that there's an imperialistic side then to the American political system as well? Or this idea of imposing, be it in Afghanistan or Iraq or the new plan that is going to come forth for here in Israel and who knows what that's going to be? Is that in there as well?
Sure. I mean, after Bush, we have two presidents, Bush, Clinton, and Obama. And I would say, I mean, it's not completely, they're not all exactly the same. There is some variation. But in general, the outlook for all four of those administrations is American empire. And we see it not just in the economic sphere. We see it in the Serbians behave badly, so we're gonna bomb the Serbian government out of existence. That was a bombing campaign that was waged directly at Serbian population centers. It was not even just against military. Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, these are all countries where somebody in Washington decides, and I'm not saying that the reasons for America to object to those governments were bad reasons, but just look at what happens. We just named four countries where the United States doesn't like what the government is doing. So the armed forces go in there, they start bombing, or they invade. Oh, I forgot Panama. They don't like the head of Panama, so they invade Panama. I mean, this is an imperial mode of thinking, that there's one law that governs the entire earth, and when someone violates that law, there's going to be a judge and jury, which is the Americans plus, you know, some help from their allies, but basically the Americans. And once a decision is made, they go in there and they'll rewrite the country's constitution and set it up as a democracy, because that's the only way things are supposed to go. Now, I think many Americans at this point understand, I mean, this is the reason that Trump was elected. Many Americans understand that the world doesn't work that way, that you can't simply just take over a country, write it a new constitution, and then 5 years later, it's going to be a democracy just like the United States. It's important to recognize how utopian the thinking of American decision-making elites, Americans and Europeans, both Democrats and Republicans. As all the major parties in both America and in Europe, for a generation after the fall of the Berlin Wall, were living in a utopian dream where they thought that they simply were going to end history and everybody was going to become, you know, an American or European. There was never any truth to that. It was always completely false, but it's like this fantasy that we are now waking up from. And I understand that all sorts of people, they have complaints. They don't like this or that tactic of some of the new nationalists or some of the personalities. I understand the fears and the objections. What I want people to understand is the other side of it, which is that waking up from this utopian dream of thinking that the entire world was going to be brought under American or European law and it was going to turn into one big EU. The people who are resisting this and trying to roll it back, they're not necessarily, you know, the most polished and most experienced politicians. They're not necessarily your first choice, but all the people who were polished and trained, they all bought into this. They all bought into this. They really believed that the United States could just govern the Middle East better than anybody in the Middle East could govern it. And here we are.
So, I mean, I think some of this came out of a fear factor. You know, we're just a couple of days out of the anniversary of 9/11, which was Saudi Arabia. And everybody is quite aware of Iran and their attempts at their version of, you know, Islamic hegemony around the world, whatever it is. So we're being told under the auspices of security that this is what has to be done. So, and there is something to that. That is a very real fear. So where do we go with this?
I think you're definitely right, but I would separate two different things. The concern for security, let's figure out who was responsible for 9/11, and let's figure it out and let's go after them, right? Nobody's going to object to that. I mean that's old style considerations of national interest. Mm-hmm. You have to secure your people. You have to secure your people. You can secure your allies. But notice that there's a huge difference between saying, does Iraq have weapons of mass destruction? We consider that dangerous. Let's go in and find them and then get out, right? That's one thing. It's something completely different to say, our goal here is to establish democracy in Iraq because the only way to get security for America is if there's going to be democracy for Iraq. Now, that just isn't true. It's not true that the only way to get security for the United States is if there's democracy in Iraq. And it's also not true that the Americans have the capacity of establishing democracy in Iraq. I mean, they were moving in there with their, you know, with like setting up liberal arts colleges. They were going to sit there and teach Tocqueville. I mean, this is a complete incapacity to understand that there really is such a thing as a different culture, a different national or civilizational heritage, an inability to see that people may be proud of their heritage. And part of this, I think, is a weakness that Americans and Europeans have. They don't seem to understand that when non-Americans and non-Europeans look at the West, they see some terrible things, right? They see America at this point has 40% of its children being born outside of marriages, and the fertility rate is dropped to European levels. The last report was at 1.76. America to many others in the world doesn't look anywhere near as successful as it looks to America. I mean, the fact that America is financially successful, that's great. That means it has an awful lot to teach the rest of the world. But even there, you know, the 2008 collapse.
Lehman Brothers, then et cetera. Yeah.
Right. That leaves people thinking, boy, you know, these capitalists, they think that they can run the economy, a single economy for the entire world because they've got it all worked out. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have it all worked out. Now, I say that as a free marketer. But if you look at American system, the destruction of the American family, the inability to make the to make Wall Street work in a way that normal people could respect, and this absurd fantasy of writing constitutions for foreign nations that are imposed on them by force, those things do not look attractive, and they shouldn't look attractive. And so this brings me back to, you know, to Irving Kristol after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that America is has so many strengths, and Europeans have so many strengths, but they need to get their house in order. It's not like they have the best way to run a country, and nobody else should experiment with anything else because they've just got it right. It isn't like that. We really do need many different nations doing things different ways so that we can see what works.
So we, in the summer, and my listeners heard this from me already, we were also in the Balkans, and we heard a lot about Serbia, and we were in Sarajevo as well. But one of the astonishing things that I heard repeatedly from people in Montenegro, in Bosnia, in Croatia, was that maybe communism wasn't so bad. And here they are with beautiful countries, a lot of natural resources. And growing up in America, this is a sentence you never expect anybody to ever say, that democracy is good, America is good, and communism and Soviet Union and all that is bad. And here we have people who used to live under Tito in Yugoslavia saying that at least then they had some kind of security blanket. Yeah, it wasn't great, and you weren't free, and if you upset the wrong person, you disappeared for 6 months into who knows where. But now they're struggling, and they don't even know sometimes where their next meal is coming from. It made me, I have to say, appreciate Israel all the more, and that coming home here and seeing what we have managed to accomplish in a constant state of either war or battle readiness and with fewer natural resources except for our people, yet here we have a country with a high fertility rate, the highest in the Western world, and we're moving along. But you still have this threat. Is it a threat of communism? I'm just throwing that out because that's usually the words that I put together, the threat of communism and of Putin or whatever's going on in the former Soviet Union. Is it necessarily a threat? Because it's sounding like what we consider the free Western world isn't much less, and I'm using the word very advisedly here, totalitarian or groupthink than some of what we were raised to believe is the classic in groupthink.
Well, you're not going to get me to say anything against the principles of limited government, private property, free enterprise, free speech. I mean, these are basic aspects of the Anglo-American tradition that grew out of the biblical heritage, which I cherish and I prize, and I don't want to live in any other way. But on the other hand, I'm afraid that many people are blinded to the failings because they're so alert to what's good in the Anglo-American tradition. They're blinded by the failings, and that's a big mistake. I mean, this business about the circumstance in which family life is simply, as we've known it, has simply ended for half the population in America, that should be the thing that is being discussed by every political figure, by every spiritual and intellectual leader, in the universities, in the media, every single day. That is a warning sign of an impending collapse of a civilization. And the fact that there are many things that we like about it doesn't change the fact that it's not tottering, and it is tottering. And what are we going to do about that? Now, the issue of socialism is, as you know, it's come up in America because in the last
Bernie Sanders, right, and all his followers
in the last generation, socialism for the first time has taken on positive connotations maybe a quarter of the population in the United States, and it's quickly growing. And that's another warning sign. That's a warning sign. And it's saying, you think you've created something that makes everybody happy, but you're wrong. You have not created something that makes everybody happy. There's a lot of people who are very unhappy. And my conservative friends, they tend to dismiss this and to say, oh, well, you know, it just shows how badly educated the millennials are. You know, if they'd gone to our universities, then, you know, then they'd know the truth. But I think this is too simplistic. I think people are looking for a deep change for reasons that are perfectly real. You eliminated the study of Bible and teaching about God from the American school system, beginning in the 1940s, then much more forcefully in the 1960s. World War II, Americans still saw themselves as a Christian people. The American Supreme Court called America a Christian people. Franklin Roosevelt had no problem saying that that America was fighting for Christian values during World War II. Now, all of that has been wiped away. And three generations of American kids now have grown up without a word of scripture or God in their educational system. That's a massive revolution. And the consequences are now unfolding in very, very dramatic ways. Is anybody going to say anything to try to change this, to try to stop it? Or is it just going to continue in this direction? If you continue in this direction, then the soft talk about socialism that you're hearing today, it may end up growing stronger, because you don't have in America anymore a Christian, conservative, Bible-based, freedom-loving heritage that had held the country together. So what's supposed to hold it together? It's not enough to say that, you know, people are free. Because people are free, they do all sorts of terrible things when they're free, not just good things. You need to have good traditions that can stabilize the country and keep it solid in order for freedom to be able to continue to exist.
Although, as you and I both know, because of our shared Jewish history, Christianity hasn't always been up there. I mean, our people have been persecuted, and you mentioned the Crusades and all through history. So you're talking here about... Are you talking here about that kind of Christian mentality or ethos to save America? But as Jews, is there a danger here?
I'm not in the business of selling Christianity. Right. You know, people who read my books know that I have plenty of problems with Christianity. Mm-hmm. They're deep problems on the theological level as well as on the moral level. But on the other hand, I think that there is a great deal to admire in Christian civilization, and especially in this Anglo-American tradition, which, for all the ups and downs and bumps in the road, has been a very, very good friend to the Jewish people. We wouldn't have a state of Israel without that Anglo-American Christian tradition. And so I see that tradition as kind of a sister tradition with the Jewish people. And you could add some others, the tradition of Dutch Protestant nationalism is also similarly related to us in its love of the Old Testament, and participated in at various periods in efforts that were very helpful to the Jews. I don't mean to whitewash anything. Of course, Christianity, like Islam, has done plenty of bad. On the other hand, if I have to choose between Christianity and the products of the godless post-Christian world, mm-hmm. Communism, socialism, Nazism, now this liberal imperialism, none of these things are attractive to me in the slightest. And I think at this stage, we really ought to be doing what we can to help our Christian friends to save their countries if it's possible. if someone becomes uncomfortable with Christianity and wants to come and find a place among the Jews, I'm sure that we'll know how to receive them. but at the moment, we're talking about countries which are not choosing between Judaism and Christianity. They're choosing between Christianity and this crazy liberal imperialism.
Mm-hmm. Or rampant secularism. Well, if we were looking for a term that brought it in together, we could say Bible. Because as you're saying, first of all, the political philosophy of nation state is coming out of the Bible, but also family. The Bible, when you read the Bible, it is all about family, quite often dysfunctional family, but it's about families and tribes. And I think there was a statistic I read a few years ago that 10, if not more, of the leaders of European countries today have no children. So they're making decisions, Merkel and May, and they are making decisions for a future that they don't have a personal stake in. So when you talk about the loss or the breakdown of the family structure as leading to the end of civilization as we know it, and we saw it with Rome as well, do you think that maybe is a part of what's at play here?
Yeah, I think the problem is that the too much of the way we live comes out of biblical ideas, which are not recognized and are not taught. Okay, so if you do like I did, you go to graduate school and you study political thought at the graduate level. There are some things that are studied intensively. The idea of individual freedom is studied intensively, and the idea of limited government and how to do it is studied intensively. And so there's certain subjects that are constantly discussed. But as I write about this in the new book, in The Virtue of Nationalism, that there's an entire side to political thought that is almost never discussed in political education at any level, not in the high schools, not in the universities, not in graduate schools, in the West. And that is, I call it the philosophy of order. What do you need in order for there to be stable, cohesive societies, for them to be able to have a government, for them to not collapse into chaos? That subject is virtually never studied in the standard political theory curriculum. What's interesting is that that's the main political subject that's of interest to the Nevi'im, the prophets, is exactly this. They start with a world in chaos, and then empires, Nimrod, who tries to suppress the chaos by building a world empire, and then Abraham leaves this, you know, Mesopotamia, these attempts at world empires, in order to live on a hill by himself at the age of, you know, 75, with goats and sheep and his family. And the question that's asked there in the Bible, is it possible to raise up a society that's outside of all of this? And what are the difficulties? Well, the first thing that happens is it turns out that you go live on that hill and then you're starving. And there's famine in every generation since Abraham, from the time that Abraham comes to live in the land until the time Joseph just takes them down to Egypt and has them stay there. All right, so the Bible is not utopian and the Bible is not naive. You can't just go live on a hill because you need food from somewhere, and the food is being supplied by these idolatrous imperial monstrosities. Mm-hmm. The entire exploration in the Bible revolves around the question of what do you need to do in order to make a state solid? What do you need to do in order to make a people be able to endure through time and pass their way of life from one generation to the next? These questions are not questions that are being asked by the standard political theory curriculum, and it's a mistake, because they just assume that America is going to last forever, that Europe's going to last forever. That you can do anything you want. You can pass any laws you want. You can give any freedoms and any rights, and it just doesn't make any difference. So people are free. They don't want to have children, so they won't have children. So what? Well, there are consequences to that. So what? And what's needed is a deep change in the way we teach young people to think about politics. Having children is the first rule of politics. And if you're not having children, then you don't understand the first rule of politics. So it doesn't make any difference. You could be the chancellor of Germany, but you don't understand anything about running a country, which you can see from the fact that she thought it would be simple to bring 1.5 million refugees from Islamic countries into Germany. She doesn't understand the first thing about politics, right? I'm just talking about being realistic. I'm not in any way disparaging the idea of immigration or that we should help people who are refugees. I'm just saying she doesn't understand the first thing about what it takes to run a country. That's true of quite a few of them. They've been very badly educated in political matters.
It's a fascinating statement, having children is the first rule of politics, because having children, pourvu, is, I believe, the first mitzvah or the first commandment, not commandment, but thing you're supposed to do in the Bible, because it's all about the future. Otherwise, you're just here for whatever, you're 60 or 70, and that's it. What world do you leave behind, and why should you care?
Exactly so. Yes, the rabbis, I believe the rabbis turn it into a mitzvah, into a commandment that you have to have children. Mm-hmm. And in Genesis, it's just a blessing. God blesses us with the ability to have a future, but we don't understand that blessing anymore. We don't necessarily see it as a blessing because because I see this even with my kids and their friends. These are religious kids growing up, you know, in religious homes and religious schools and everything, but they're scared to have children. They definitely are. The liberal environment has had a big impact on them. Why are they scared? They're scared because they feel like they'll be giving up their freedom. And they've been taught, not by me, not in my house, but the environment teaches them that freedom is the only value. Freedom's the only value. So if somebody comes and says, well, get married young and have a lot of children because that's the first rule of politics. You want your family to flourish. You want your nation to flourish. You want mankind to flourish. So you have to have children. And that's fine in the abstract. But what really matters to them is that they've been taught that they need to be free. And getting married, that's being less free. Having children, that's being less free. Any kind of move that will maybe get you some kind of big payoff in the long run, but it means giving up on your freedom now. Well, they're not. They find it very difficult to take that kind of step, because freedom is the only value that's being taught. This is the result of an education system that thinks enlightenment is universal reason, that it's the right way to teach everybody. And it's actually an extremely impoverished and insufficient way of thinking about the world.
And dangerous. You have 9 children, I believe. I have 7. So we seem to have taken that seriously. Although it occurs to me, you talk about Abraham sitting on his hill, but so much of the story of Abraham and Sarah is about having children. I mean, without that, where do we go? Although the book that I mentioned before, The Philosophy of Hebrew Scripture, you very much quote Jeremiah the prophet. And as far as I know, he doesn't get married or have children. So here you have this tremendous prophet and philosopher who is so, I think, caught up with his people that he isn't free to have that, which you now, and a lot of us say, is seen as a burden.
I think there's all sorts of different kinds of people in different kinds of situations. Moses isn't exactly a family man either.
David doesn't come across as a great dad either.
I don't, I don't think it's right to come up with a rule and expect it to apply cookie cutter like to every single person in every single situation. Different people have different strengths. God gives them different roles in history, and that's always something that's important to keep in mind. What I was thinking about is comparing our generation with our children's generation, mm-hmm. where even 30 years ago, all of my, you know, just about all of my friends saw it as obvious that they were going to get married, they were going to have children, they were going to that was a way of building. That was a way of building a life for themselves, mm-hmm. and the fact that that entails giving up some of your adolescent freedom, it didn't really scare anybody. I don't remember people being worried about it. Of course, there were always those individuals who didn't want to get tied down just yet because they weren't, you know, they hadn't done enough drinking. I remember that. But here I'm talking about something different. I'm talking about it, you know, in the Orthodox community, the on both sides of the Atlantic, they talk about the shidduch crisis, which, right, the crisis. Why aren't the kids getting married? And there is a reason why the kids aren't getting married. And I'm not talking about certain special individuals who have their, you know, their particular talents or their particular problems. I'm talking about the generation. The generation has this problem that they don't have an intuitive sense of why you would take big risks with your freedom in order to get big payoff in terms of being able to build something, mm-hmm. a family, a tribe, a nation, a world. They're not builders. Because to be a builder, you have to be willing to take risks. I am really worried about this, mm-hmm. about this infiltration of the diseases of liberalism and Enlightenment thinking deep into the Orthodox community, and I'm including the Haredi community deep into the Orthodox community. Individual freedom is a very precious thing. Nobody takes it more seriously than I do, but it's just one precious thing. You can't build a world on this one precious thing. It's one out of a number of very, very basic things. You take a document like the American Constitution. Americans are always talking about freedom all the time. So are Europeans. Like that's all the time. But the American Constitution begins with a description of what's the goal in reconstituting the American states. And they say in order to form a more perfect union. Okay, the first thing they say is national unity. And notice national unity is not the same thing as individual freedom. It's almost the opposite. It means that you have to give up something in order to be unified.
Like a marriage, incidentally, you're giving up personal freedoms in order to have a unity as a couple with different goals as a couple.
And I have a chapter that I'm very proud of in the Virtue of Nationalism about marriage and family in order to try to help people understand what a nation is. I want them first to understand what a marriage and a family is. So to go back to this American example, so unity, to provide justice, domestic tranquility, none of these things are freedom. And then when they finally get around to talking about the blessings of liberty, which is certainly crucial and is certainly there, they say for ourselves and our posterity, meaning it's not enough to be to be thinking about your freedom. Mm-hmm. You have to be thinking about the freedom of the next generations, which is in fact a restriction on your freedom if you have to think about the freedom of next generations. Because to begin with, there have to be next generations, and that's on you. So that's a beautifully articulated picture of what a national government pursues. And it's not freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom is crucial, but it's just one thing.
I think the Pew report that came out specifically about the Jewish world in North America last year said, because the numbers are dropping, and they were surprised, the results weren't because of assimilation or marrying out of the, you know, marrying a non-Jewish partner. They were actually because of Jews just never getting married at all and never establishing families at all. And that was a detail that they did not expect to see. But you have now many that, and it's such a core of the Jewish religion. So many of our holidays, like we're in the holiday season now, are around family, around the table, around passing on traditions. We left Egypt. We stood at Sinai. These are the things that we learned from our forefathers that we want to pass down in perpetuity. And where is all that going? So we come back to whatever religion it is, be it Judaism, be it Protestant or other religions. It's really such a biblical idea, this core idea. But you're saying here that this also flows into the politics, that these are really, what I'm coming down to is, if you had to put the Bible in a shelf and reference it, what section would you put it in? Because it's everything. It's the politics, it's the family, sometimes it's a murder mystery, sometimes it's whatever. it seems to cover it all. And some of the other books that you have written, and I have to talk about this also because I've been following you for so long, Esther, the book of Esther, when we've lost for the first time our sovereignty as a people, and now we're struggling in someone else's country to maintain ourselves and being threatened with annihilation. So it all just comes down to holding yourself together as a people so that the world as a whole can be a better place. Like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts when it comes to nations on this planet.
Well, if you believe your nation has nothing special to offer, it makes sense. So don't have children, don't raise them in the religious and national customs of your people, because you just don't think it's worth anything, and you can, you know, live like the flies of summer, that, you know, you live for today and you'll be gone tomorrow, and that's it. If you care at all about the world that you're leaving and the billions of people who have to live in it, then your attitude has to be, I think, very different. And the best place to learn about the attitude of someone who wants to advance the world and better it is in Scripture. And our formula definitely begins with the family and builds out from there, which brings us back to the question of nationalism. Individuals should take responsibility to build families of their own. And every family is unique. No two are alike. And the same thing is true with your community, your clan, your tribe. And nations in all of this have a very special role, because they are the basic division of a world of mankind that's a competitive world, in which different nations carry different ideas. They carry different theories and different practices about what it means to be a human being. The Jewish people has played a larger role in this competition of ideas than virtually any other people in the world, maybe than any other people in the world. It surprises me that Jewish children don't necessarily want to take part in that, but when I see the destruction that that Enlightenment ideas are bringing to one country after another, I actually you know, and I look back at the Jews and at Israel, I think, wow, we're so much healthier than all the other nations that have been blighted by this. Thank God we should all have a good year, Jews and Christians and people of goodwill who are trying to fight for the freedom of their nations and to hand down scripture and a knowledge of God.
I can't think of a better way to end this interview. Dr. Yoram Chazoni, author of, among many, The Virtue of Nationalism. Get it, read it, and then put it into play. Don't just leave it between your ears. Thank you so much for joining me today, and Gmar Chatima Tova to you and to your family.
Shana Tova.
This week on Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston, tune in to an exclusive interview with Jason Greenblatt, White House Chief Envoy to the Middle East.
At the end of the day, if we don't resolve the situation in Gaza, it will be an obstacle on the road to peace. So separate from the humanitarian issue, Hamas itself is an obstacle on the road to peace.
That's Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.